Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a bit of a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. There are few who understand that battle space better or are doing more to help illuminate it for the rest of us than our first guest, our regular feature, I'm happy to say, here at Secure Freedom Radio, Diana West, syndicated columnist and author of Death of the Grown-Up, among other marvelous insights into the challenges of our time. And Diana, you have been following closely this business about Benghazi Gate, and I want to make sure that I've got a sense of where you think we are now as a result of now several days of hearings on Capitol Hill and some further leaks in the press and elsewhere.
Yes, I think we are stalling. I think that we are about to head into the holiday season. I'm tremendously worried that we are going to lose our grip on the story. Right now, I've been watching what I consider, frankly, a red herring pursuit of who changed the talking points, where we just had General Petraeus appear for a second time before the House Intelligence Committee. And according to my analysis here, it appears that the former CIA director lied to the House committee back in September and may have lied a second time to the committee on November 16th. This is not attracting the attention it deserves. It is a scandal. It is also a felony. It's true. If knowingly he deceived the committee on Benghazi, it is a felony. It needs to be addressed.
What is it that you're seeing that represents this sort of evidence of lying, Diana West?
Yes. Well, in the closed-door hearing back in September 14th, we had the ranking Democrat come out afterwards, thank goodness, Dutch Ruppersberger, and speak very frankly about what the briefing had been like to ABC News. We have an on-the-record, in a sense, on-the-record record of what he took away from the Petraeus briefing, which was an hour-long briefing in September, 3 days after the attack. And Ruppersberger makes it very clear that what he heard led him to believe there was a spontaneous protest that went on for 2 or 3 hours, and he found this very relevant to the argument that this was not a planned terrorist attack, even though extreme groups that may have had al-Qaeda connections could have been ultimately involved. But the narrative that the White House set and followed for 2 weeks and was joined in by then-CIA Director Petraeus was a fraud. We know that the White House and the rest of official Washington knew, at least within the first day of the attack on September 11th and 12th, that there was no protest, spontaneous or otherwise. There was a planned terrorist assault by al-Qaeda-linked groups to commemorate 9/11. This was lied about, and it looks like General Petraeus was part of the conspiracy.
We're being told, Diana, that as part of this sort of fulmination, the Director of National Intelligence's office was involved in stripping out this reference to a terrorist attack in the talking points. DNI's office is now saying, well, no, it was actually the intelligence community that did that. And then there are some who say, no, it was a deputies committee, a group of political appointees, principally, very senior level folks in the White House who did it. I appreciate that you don't think this is the right focus, but just to get this nailed down, do you have a sense of where the truth lies on all of that?
No, I don't, and I think that's intentional. This is a matter of people pointing fingers at each other. A bureaucratic cloud will descend over that, and no one is even asking the question, who put into the talking points the clearly fraudulent point that there was a protest of any kind in Benghazi? This was part of the White House effort to link Benghazi, a separate planned terrorist attack, to the Islamic rage cycle that was kicking off beginning in Cairo over a movie, over free speech, essentially, over the First Amendment, ultimately. And this is what Petraeus was party to. And getting back to his second offense, apparent, we learned from Representative King, who gave a very tortured kind of press conference after the second Petraeus appearance, where his admiration for Petraeus was made very clear, and you could kind of pull the facts out from among the various testimonials he was making to Petraeus, that Petraeus was insisting he'd been straight with the committee all along and that there was a planned terrorist attack. And this clearly did not square with, one, Peter King's memory of the September 14 hearing, and two, more important really, Representative Repersberger's September 14th account of the briefing, which we have on the record thanks to ABC's reporting.
Yeah. Let's turn quickly now, Diana, to the underlying question that you've said should be a focus, along with, I'd like to think, the whole question of what indeed are we doing with respect to our policies in this space, our embrace of Islamists, namely the embrace of the Islamists at the moment, at least, preeminent agenda, namely suppressing our freedom of speech. You had this narrative, as you say, injected into the whole controversy over this set of talking points that injected into the talking points themselves. And then more recently, we had apparently the U.S. Consul General in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, attending and contributing to an effort by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation to advance this very agenda of suppressing our First Amendment rights. What's going on here?
Absolutely. Well, this was Ann Casper, the Consul General in Jeddah, attending a symposium called Defamation of Islam. And yes, she was an active participant in this, clearly part and parcel with what we know as the Istanbul Process, which is the joint United States Organization of Islamic Cooperation effort to criminalize criticism of Islam, to tamp down our free speech, to gut the First Amendment. This is highly serious, and Benghazi, while it functions on many levels as a national security scandal and hit on us and big piece of our history, it is clearly a piece of this effort to remove our First Amendment protections by our own government. And here you see the U.S. government with Ann Casper participating in it in the headquarters of the OIC.
And Diana, again, you have been documenting these predations, shall we say, on the part of the OIC and the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists on the one hand, and our own government on the other. Connect the dots here for us. What do we make of the fact that the administration is so intent on promoting this false narrative against the backdrop of the pressure to submit to this Sharia blasphemy business, and especially as it relates to this question of the explanations given to Congress?
Yes, well, I think that there are probably two very important reasons to look at. I think one is sort of the naked political expedient. Having America take a lethal al-Qaeda hit on an anniversary of 9/11 destroys the Obama campaign mantra that because Osama bin Laden was dead, al-Qaeda and the whole jihad threat was dead as well. This was blown out of the water in Benghazi. But in a sense, more important in an existential way, The United States engaged in this Istanbul process. I believe the government was looking toward the September 25th United Nations meeting, where President Obama addressed the world body, which is dominated by the Islamic bloc nations, 56 nations plus the Palestinian Authority, where he cited the video six times and declared, again, one of the most outrageous statements, probably the most outrageous statement an American president has ever made. He said, "The future must not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam." This was an utter negation of the First Amendment, among many other things. But this is part of the program that I believe this administration is at the forefront of, with the OIC, with Hillary Clinton as the front man, if you will, acting with the OIC to prohibit criticism of Islam under the guise of defamation of religion. And we see the active involvement of this administration in this, and the American people are not being told the facts about this. And again, Benghazi is so important to this because it unlocks, it is a key toward this and other policies that have really put us on the wrong side of the jihad in general.
I could not agree with you more, Diana West, and I appreciate enormously your reporting on this and your explication of it here with us at Secure Freedom Radio. I want to also commend to people your website, dianawest.net, and a marvelous photograph you have there of the same Anne Casper presenting the 25,000th visa to a Saudi. Given just this year. Fascinating insight into what we're up against. Diana, thank you again for joining us, and we'll talk with you again very soon. In the meantime, happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. Next up, Peter Pham takes us inside Africa. What's happening there, and what does it mean for you? Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Dr. Peter Pham. He is currently with the esteemed Atlantic Council here in Washington, D.C., a man we turn to, as do many others, for insights into the nature of the challenges that are emerging and opportunities, for that matter, on the continent of Africa. And Peter, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Frank, it's always a pleasure.
You've written recently a very interesting piece about, despite the divisions, partisan divisions in Washington, there actually seems to be a degree of bipartisanship with respect to Africa. Why is that? It seems unique, but do you think it's real? And indeed, at least if it is real, is it durable?
Well, Frank, it is real. I think part of it, one could almost cynically say that's because those who are really committed to Africa are so few that if we divided ourselves ourselves along too many lines, we find ourselves talking to ourselves and then be taken away by the men in white suit. There's a certain truth to that, though. But I think also because there's Africa's always been in U.S. foreign policy less contentious, and you have a broad coalition, for example, in issues like South Sudan, for example, where it was a coalition of brought together the Congressional Black Caucus on one side, Christian evangelicals on the other, and human rights activists in between, which really helped the U.S. help push the independence of South Sudan. And there are other issues like that. And so Africa has genuinely been one of the few areas where the Republicans and Democrats have managed to work together with a fairly decent amount of comity.
Well, I wonder if in part that also reflects the fact that we've not been really since Somalia engaged in any terribly controversial activities there. But some seem to be looming on the horizon, Peter, and I wanted to visit with you about a couple of them. As we speak, apparently there's been some new insurrection in Congo that may have considerable implications, not only obviously for the people most immediately involved, but also for several of its neighbors. What's going on there, and what do you recommend we do and say about it?
Well, it's a very complex situation because essentially, the crisis, which is taking place in the eastern part of the rather ironically named Democratic Republic of the Congo, the part that borders upon Uganda and Rwanda, is really unfinished business from the Rwandan genocide nearly 20 years ago. At that time, some of those who were engaged in the massacres fled over there, were given shelter by the Congo's then dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko. And as a result, the Rwandan army, the army that liberated Rwanda from the killers, pursued them there. And it's been back and forth. So that's part of the issue there. But there's also an issue of the fact that the government of the Congo itself is not particularly legitimate. The international community denounced the last election a year ago as a fraud. The Catholic bishops of the country, who had deployed over 40,000 election observers, called it illegitimate. But after all that, the international community went away and allowed the man who stole the election to assume office. So not that I'm encouraging rebellions, especially by this bloody group, but it's an understandable reaction when you have an illegitimate government foisted upon a country. So it's a very complex situation, and it's turning into a dire humanitarian situation. This rebel group, the M23, took over Goma, the capital of one of the provinces of eastern Congo, North Kivu, just earlier this week, and there are 1 million people there. Interestingly, make one final note about this, was that the UN peacekeepers who were there and made the town their headquarters simply stood aside as the rebels came in, and the explanation was that they had no mandate to do anything about that. They were there on a different mission.
Fascinating. And again, well, we will be watching it closely with your help, Peter Pham, I'm sure. Let me ask you about another instance in which we had an attack that took place. It is assumed to have been conducted by Israel against a facility in Sudan. Talk to us about what we know about the attack and its purpose and how it relates, it appears, to what Israel is now confronting from the Gaza Strip.
For several years now, Sudan has been, and here I permit me to quote the Iranian foreign minister himself, has been the pivot of Iran's policy in Africa. And one of the things it's enabled the mullahs in Tehran to do is use it as a transshipment point for weapons, which they have sent up to through Sudan, up through Egypt, across the Sinai and into Gaza to the Palestinian militants, including the terrorist group Hamas. Including among those things shipped were the Farjah rockets, which now are reaching Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And so in recent years, there have been, previous to October, three separate incidents where an unknown outside power, presumably Israel, intervened to either bomb a convoy of weapon smugglers, attack a vessel delivering weapons, or in a case earlier this year in May, an explosion which killed a major arms smuggler. Now, what was unique about what happened in October was that in response to these attacks over the years, the Iranians decided instead of shipping arms in and through Sudan, they would work with the Sudanese government in Khartoum and build them on the spot. So they created a weapons factory south of Khartoum in a place called Yarmouk. And in mid-October, in the middle of the night, someone flew four fighter bombers over Yarmouk, dropped ordnance and blew up 21 buildings, destroyed what satellite imagery shows us to be some 40 shipping containers full of weapons that were presumably destined for Hamas. So it wiped out this weapons factory. And so it, in retrospect, it might have been, and is, one could speculate that it might have been an Israeli preemptive strike in advance of the offensive against the provocations coming out of Gaza to eliminate a resupply possibility. I would also add there's an interesting little tidbit that many people in Washington have been saying that the Israelis could not hit Iran 1,700 kilometers from Israel. They couldn't refuel and carry it out. This little attack on Sudan, if it was done by Israel, coincidentally, is exactly the same distance. And if it was Israel that did it, they certainly flew undetected there and back. So that's a little bit of a signal, if nothing else.
Yeah, an impressive bit of intelligence, tradecraft, as well as military derring do, and the kind of thing one expects of the Israelis. I hope that it not only had a salutary effect in constricting this supply of these weapons that have really put now the principal population centers, as you know, of Israel in jeopardy, Peter, but also send a message to the Iranians. Peter, quickly, in the minute and a half or so we have left with you, Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, today announced that the United States was widening its operations against al-Qaeda. As you and I have talked about, I'm very much of the view that al-Qaeda is not the only problem we face, but one of the countries that he described is now going to be a focus of intensified activity is Mali. Quickly remind us what's going on there and what do you expect might come of this announcement?
Well, northern Mali was taken over earlier this year in March, April, by an alliance of local Islamists who call themselves Ansar Dine, the defenders of the faith, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, the local al-Qaeda franchise, and a group that's known by its French acronym Mujahid, which is the movement for unity and jihad in West Africa, which, if you can believe it or not, is a more radical offshoot of al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which claims al-Qaeda is not radical enough. And they've taken over an area the size of Texas, driven out the government, the very weak government forces there, and established their own very brutal regime of their version of Sharia, with not just amputation, but cross amputations, public floggings, stonings, and other acts of terrorism on the civilian population. And disturbingly, they're also attracting fighters from as far away as the Sahrawi out of Western Sahara and Algeria to the Sudanese and others from further afield. So it's becoming, in many respects, a new Afghanistan. And the international community has been kind of trying to figure out what to do here because of a number of complicating factors that make this a very difficult and delicate operation. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the coming months. It's a vast area, as I said, the size of Texas. It's now held entirely by these Islamists. And the question is going to be whether there's political will on the part of Mali, its neighbors, and the international community to prevent this from becoming worse than it already is.
We'll watch that closely as well. Dr. Peter Pham, thank you for your insights, as always, and your contributions to our understanding of what's going on in Africa, a tremendously important part of the world. And thanks for the good work you do at the Atlantic Council. We'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Have a good Thanksgiving in the meantime. Next up,
thank you.
We'll be speaking with Jim Hansen about what is going on elsewhere in the world from the boots-on-the-ground perspective. Straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way
for an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. God bless Alan West. The freshman Florida congressman and decorated U.S. Army combat veteran explained last night on Sean Hannity's TV program on Fox News why our diplomatic personnel and facilities in the Middle East are under attack. He attributes it to the weakness President Obama has exhibited since coming to office. That weakness is in part made manifest by the Obama administration's dimitude toward the Muslim world, the practice of submission that Islamic supremacists use violence and the threat of violence to impose. He notes that the Muslim Brotherhood seeks our destruction and hopes to advance that goal by seizing on a silly little Facebook video that came out 6 months ago. Alan West says we must reject the Islamists' demand that we give up our freedoms and submit. Now that's leadership. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Roger Noriega, our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio on matters involving our own hemisphere, matters that he is intimately familiar with, in part as a result of his distinguished service to our country as an Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and as the U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States, now with the American Enterprise Institute and the driving force behind a terrific website, InterAmericanSecurityWatch.com. Roger Noriega, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
What do we know, if anything, about the health of Venezuela dictator Hugo Chavez at the moment? We've been watching this cancer progress now for some time. Do you have any updates or insights into his condition?
Our sources continue to say that the cancer has done irreparable damage to his health, that it's terminal, and it's interesting that since his triumphant so-called election, he's been virtually invisible. He's appeared a couple of times briefly. They've had to postpone the swearing-in of his new defense minister because for health reasons. So I think that the Venezuelan people and really the rest of the world needs to be ready for Chavez's demise, because it could provoke an extraordinarily chaotic environment in an important South American country.
And this apparently is a sentiment shared by the former president of Brazil, as I understand it, as well.
That's a great point, Frank, because Lula, Inácio da Silva, who knows Chavez extraordinarily well, is another one of these Castro acolytes, said just recently after Chavez's election that he should be planning his successor. So he obviously knows something that we don't, that Chavez doesn't want to admit, which is here's a guy who was just elected to a 5-year term in office, and one of his best chums is saying that they need to talk about who's going to succeed him as president. So I think that gives away a lot of information about what they expect for Chavez's health in the future.
Yeah, and Roger Noriega, on your website, you have a piece that indicates some of the toll that the Chavez regime has taken on its own people, let alone the threat that it has represented to us as he has pursued this Castro-like agenda with the help of Lula and others. But it's a fascinating and troubling depiction of the problem domestically, to the effect that Venezuelan manufacturing is now roughly where it was 50 years ago.
Right.
How bad is that for the people of Venezuela?
Well, it's a tragedy because, well, frankly, Venezuelans don't make anything anymore. They import everything. This is a country with one of the lowest percentages of cultivated arable land, so they don't farm. And now their manufacturing level is back to 1965 levels. And you see the private sector decimated systematically because Chavez wants to have everyone dependent on the state. And so Americans need to pay attention to this lesson. I don't want to be overly dramatic, but quite frankly, this is what happens when, politicized unions destroy a manufacturing base. Everybody ends up on the dole. And even a country with that's taken in $1 trillion in oil revenue in the last decade is flat on its back, and people aren't productive, and they depend more and more on largesse of a state that then turns to them and demands that they reelect them, and it should come as no surprise that they win reelection.
Yeah, a cautionary tale indeed for our own country. There's some strong similarities there. Let me ask you, Roger Noriega, you have been, of course, very concerned about one other facet of the Chavez regime and its agenda, specifically narco-trafficking that has taken place, including with the direct involvement, it appears, of some of his senior subordinates. You testified last week about this phenomenon of narco-trafficking and terrorism on Capitol Hill. Tell us about your testimony and the insights that you thought were most important to convey to the Congress at a moment when its oversight is urgently needed in this area.
Well, certainly, this was Chairman Mike McCall's subcommittee at Homeland Security, and they're focusing on the border, but have had the wisdom to look downrange and see this threat as it's taking shape with this alliance between Iran and Venezuela. That is to say, between a terrorist state and a narco state. That's literally senior leadership of Venezuela are all wanted or known narco traffickers. Terrorists use Venezuela as a safe haven, as a base of operations, to project not only their operations, but the narco, the money-making schemes, all the way up to our border in Central America and Mexico. So this is the point I was making. This isn't just criminality. This is asymmetrical warfare being waged against us. And if we continue to turn a blind eye, it's going to bite us in a very bad way. And I think Congress's leadership is absolutely essential. One of the things they need to be demanding is from the Justice Department, of Eric Holder's Justice Department, where are the indictments of these narcos? They've done years and years of work out of the Southern District of New York studying the narco state of Venezuela, and we need to bring these people to justice and send a very clear signal to the rest of the world that that's a narco-terrorist regime. And Eric Holder or someone is sitting on these indictments, and I think Congress needs to demand answers about that as well.
What kind of reaction did you get from Michael McCaul's subcommittee? And do you sense that this is, in fact, going to be a feature of congressional oversight in the new Congress?
Absolutely. He doesn't have to be taught any lessons about this himself. His subcommittee has done some excellent work for years on the subject. And what's also very important, Frank, is it's bipartisan recognition. We need more and more of that. There's a legislation by Republican Jeff Duncan of South Carolina that passed the House unanimously in the summer. It's now being considered in the Senate, and I understand that it's there's bipartisan support on there. Bob Menendez, Marco Rubio, among others, want to see that legislation passed, which will require the executive branch to produce a strategy for dealing with Iran's presence in Latin America. And it's a very good initiative, and it's good that it enjoys bipartisan support. Hopefully it will pass, and that one or two senators can't hold it up.
Well, we will be following it closely with your good help. Roger Noriega, as I say, is the guy we turn to on Latin American affairs, based in no small measure on his expertise accumulated in public service at the highest levels of the United States government. Roger, one last item. In connection with narco-trafficking and narco-terrorism, one of the worst perpetrators of this business has been the so-called FARC group in Colombia. It has been engaged of late with the relatively new government there in negotiations. We have a new commander of U.S. Southern Command who came to office and enthused about these negotiations. Tell us what you know about this new commanding general, and whether you expect this his arrival on the scene will make a difference in our awareness of and engagement in Latin America.
I hope it's an improvement. I think there's been a lack of vigor from his predecessor, with all due respect. And frankly, these are people who are trained and committed to meeting our enemies and destroying them. And frankly, I have great respect for them, and they want to keep the destruction to a minimum, and I understand that. But I have doubts about this negotiation with essentially a terrorist group, the FARC, which is named by the United States as a terrorist group. And so negotiations with that kind of group, I think, should be received with a certain amount of skepticism. And I can understand why the Colombian people want peace, but beating the terrorists and denying them the resources that they sustain their activities with is another way of defeating them. Hopefully they'll be very clear-eyed before they reach any agreements that will really resuscitate this group politically in Colombia, because they have no credibility politically otherwise.
Yeah, amen on that. We'll be watching as well the performance of General John Kelly, the new commander, and as I say, and as you say, hopefully a considerable improvement over that of his predecessor, General Douglas Frazier. Thank you so much, Roger Noriega. I wish you the best for the holiday, and deeply appreciate both your past service to our country and that you're providing, among other things, by talking with us. Next up, we'll be speaking with Jim Hansen about some of these developments on the world stage from the boots on the ground perspective. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta system, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta system to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta system by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta system from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight. 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jim Hansen, our duty guy on the boots on the ground perspective on these highfalutin policy issues and national security challenges we're facing. Jim is currently with ABSEO and formerly a Green Beret in the United States Army. Jim, let's talk a little bit about the status of the conflict between Israel and the Islamists, notably on the borders and in the surrounding areas of Gaza. What is your read on what Israel is up to there, and do you think they're likely to undertake a ground invasion to try to diminish the threat that continues, obviously, from Hamas-stan?
Yeah, well, Frank, I think, the surface of it is pretty straightforward. You know, the Hamas-stanians have been upping their rocket launching into Israel, and at some point that becomes intolerable. So, you know, taking care of that is a pretty straightforward self-defense action. On a more strategic level, I've read and heard some interesting discussion around the idea that if Israel takes away a lot of the capability, you know, by destroying it, of Hamas to attack them, that may create a situation where, given that degradation, that is one of Iran's main ways to strike back if Israel were to attack them, would be through the surrogates of Hamas and then also Hezbollah. So if Hamas is degraded directly and Hezbollah is less capable of being supplied due to the instability in Syria, that may provide a tipping point for Israel to consider making a strike against Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Yeah.
And I find that pretty plausible.
Jim, we were talking earlier in the program with Dr. Peter Pham, a specialist on Africa, about some of what appear to be Israeli operations against Sudan and Iranian weapons shipment programs and perhaps manufacturing of some of these longer-range so-called Fajr 5 rockets that have been used now against both Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. As an old Special Forces guy, I imagine that you are both following to some extent and appreciative of the skills that the Israelis evidently are bringing to bear to track and try to inflict as much disruptive effect as they can on this this collaboration between the Iranians, Sudan, and Israel's enemies in Gaza.
Yeah, no, I think it's beautiful, and I am constantly amazed by the strategic capabilities the Israelis have. We as Americans have more technical capabilities and more resources than anyone, but we suck at strategy. And we just never managed to get out of our own way. And the Israelis, with nowhere near the resources, nowhere near the manpower or anything, constantly leverage their abilities to disrupt their enemies and to stay alive. And I am always, always appreciative of that. And I think if you probably took a look at the web being put together right now, it would not surprise me if sometime in the not-too-distant future there were some unexplained explosions and some large, interesting things happening in Iran, because they just can't let that go, and it's not going to get better. You know, it's an infection that needs to be dealt with, and they will.
And as Peter Pham noted, Jim Henson, the distance from Israel to Sudan just happens to be the distance from Israel to Iran and some of those targets that might go boom in the night. We'll be watching it closely with you, of course, as well as others. Jim, let me ask you about something else. And again, I prize your not only common sense approach to this, but obviously your experience in uniform and sort of the ability to bring a perspective from inside the ranks. One of the things that, of course, has been a matter of some national attention, shall we say, for the past couple of weeks has been infidelity at the senior-most ranks of the United States military, or former military in the case of General David Petraeus. There are also reports that large numbers of commanders in the Navy in particular have been relieved of command, I think something on the order of 22 of them this year alone. And the impression is that at least some number of these are as a result of personal misconduct. I'd like to get your sense, Jim, if I could, as to whether these sorts of behavioral problems, shall we say, perhaps in violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, certainly contrary to the standards of conduct that the military holds itself to, are evidence of a fraying of the military, or are these just people, engaged in the well-established human weaknesses of the flesh? Is this symptomatic in your estimation of a problem that is simply evidence that the society itself is in trouble? What do you think?
Yeah, how about all of it? I mean, unfortunately, you know, there is a long-standing problem with people being away from their families and doing things that they probably shouldn't be. I think without a doubt, you know, decade plus of war, long deployments, our operational tempo for the past 10 years is higher than it's been any time since probably World War II. You know, as far as, you know, maybe to some extent in Vietnam, but I'm not sure if you did the math that works out. So people away from home for that long, bad things are going to happen. And I think you make a fair point about societal fraying. You know, the mores that used to hold us together, even though the military holds itself to a higher standard, the military is made up of the citizens of the United States. And we as a country are fairly decrepit. So I think all those together are causing, you know, some of the problems you mentioned. And I guess it's good that the military is dealing with it. It certainly doesn't make anybody look good in the process. Hopefully they'll weed out the people whose judgment we shouldn't be relying on.
Yeah. One of the things that we've been seeing, Jim, is a report in the Washington Post this week about the difficulties that military families are having coping with this phenomenon, that it's kind of a taboo subject in the generally very tightly woven communities of those, particularly, as you say, deployed for long periods of time. Is this a new strain on the sort of military's support system, as well as the personnel most immediately involved? And should we be worrying about it, its implications for the future ability of the all-volunteer force to perform as needed?
Yes, it is an additional strain, and the military has a long-established tradition of overreacting to whatever the problem of the day is. So I think we'll probably end up with, you know, some version of chastity belt activity for all deployed troops and a high visibility of this to the point, you know, that it makes it ridiculous. And, you know, in the end, will that change the culture? Somewhat, you know, it will have an impact on it. But this is, you know, this is the biggest problem in human relations between, you know, males and females forever. So I don't think anybody's got any plan that's going to fix it anytime soon or ever.
Yeah, well, it is one of those questions that occurs to me when we think about, you know, increasing the number of females in the ranks, particularly in advanced combat deployed positions. It seems like a, well, I guess the legal term for it is an attractive nuisance that is almost certainly going to exacerbate some of these problems. Jim, very quickly on one last point, we are looking at the sequestration cuts looming. I'm told that senior legislators responsible for the national security are not being included in the talks on the fiscal cliff. As a military man, as a guy who understands what all this might mean for the troops, are you concerned about that?
100% concerned, Frank, because here's what I think has happened. I think they've just decided that no one is going to stand up and say we can't afford to cut the military. I think given the argument, given Obama's victory and the flexibility that gives him, there's no heart to make the fight. So I think they're just going to throw the military under the bus off the cliff first. You know, the military is going first, and I don't think anybody has the, you know, intestinal fortitude to stand up and do the right thing. So it's just going to happen. And whatever cuts there were are going to happen. And they'll just count those as the, you know, some of the money that they can afford to save so they don't have to cut benefits and all the powerful entitlements.
We hope you're wrong on that, Jim, needless to say, and are doing everything we can to discourage it. It's the height of folly, needless to say. Jim, you are a great resource, as always. We appreciate what you do for us. I hope you'll have a great Thanksgiving and come back to us again next week. We wish you all a good Thanksgiving as well, and look forward to talking with you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.